Hello and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. Now, those of you who know me know that human-centered leadership and inclusivity are going to be a real focus for me and this podcast series throughout 2021. I've been looking forward to this episode on a personal note because it was an opportunity for me to reconnect with someone who is very dear to my heart, someone who I've worked with and been led by, and who is without a doubt one of the most human-centered leaders I've ever had the privilege of working with. So it's no surprises that this episode is about inclusive leadership as I talk to the wonderful Cheryl Stokes, partner at Heidrick & Struggles based in the US. Please enjoy this episode, I hope, as much as I did recording it.
In a constantly changing world, today is as simple as it gets. You're listening to The Leadership Enigma, a podcast to explore, experiment, and power up your leadership to make the difference to your business, your people, and your success. Whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, or corporate executive, each week we dig deep into global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors. Now, here's your host, Adam Pacifico.
So I'll say, welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. And actually, to be fair, Cheryl, I have to be honest, I've been trying to get you on this show for ages because I have the wonderful and the lovely Cheryl Stokes with me, who's currently a partner at Heidrick & Struggles in the US. And I've got a soft spot, Cheryl. I don't want to embarrass you now, but you're without a doubt one of the most empathetic and humble people and leaders I've ever had the privilege of working with, which is why I've been so keen to get you on the show.
Oh, thank you, Adam. That is very kind. And you know, the feeling's mutual.
I know, I really do. Now, you know, I've had the pleasure of working with you and being led by you. And I've also had the pleasure of us working side by side on some amazing global projects. But let's give a little bit of context. Just give everyone an idea of your background, because everyone I have on the show has got a great and unique story. So tell us a little bit about your story.
Sure. Well, I'm originally from Flint, Michigan, the birthplace of General Motors. I grew up with the whole family that worked on the line in GM. So I'm the parent. My parents were auto workers on the assembly floor.
Yeah.
I started working at GM as an engineering co-op student when I was in high school. That led me to an engineering career, worked there for a bit. And then when I graduated, I went to the aluminum or aluminium, as you might say. industry as an engineer. And it was there that I really was first exposed to this thought of diversity, inclusion, and more broadly, leadership. I formed a point of view then that some of the more interesting challenges had to do with people versus technology. And went to graduate school, very fortunate to be in a program at MIT called Leaders for Manufacturing.
Right.
And it was at the time where there was the Organizational Learning Center was there with Peter Senge and that whole set of people. And my focus was on learning culture and change. And that really shifted the trajectory of my career. That led me to the Coca-Cola company.
Yes, where of course.
I was an internal consultant around change and learning. And I also happened to be at Coca-Cola when I was being privileged to work with the person who, he didn't have the role officially, but it was sort of Coke's first chief diversity officer, to help the company think about how it would change in response to the things that were happening. And worked on setting up affinity groups and thinking about a curriculum and ultimately in exploring some of the public-private partnerships that Coke did. That led me to a business where we met eventually.
We did.
Started by Duke University to do customized leadership and executive development. And as you know, I spent 18 years there in a variety of roles. My last and I think very favorite role there was leading Duke's business in Europe.
Yes.
Where we were close colleagues and had a chance to have you on just a spectacular team. And then moved back to the States in 2018 and joined Heidrick & Struggles shortly thereafter as a partner. And I joined our firm for a variety of reasons, the culture, the leadership, the intellectual capital. And I was fascinated and very excited by the firm's commitment to diversity and inclusion. And I'm very privileged in our firm to work across leadership development, diversity and inclusion and culture shaping, three areas that I just have passion around and have worked really over the last 30 years. So that's me. my journey.
I like it. So that's you. Obviously, you know, we have worked and continue to work with leaders and leadership across sectors, levels, and geographies. And a culture of inclusivity is something that many organizations have been working on and are working on. And I know that it's important to you. It really is a passion to you about helping people shape a culture of inclusivity.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about where that passion comes from.
Yeah, I think it comes from my lived experience and being in organizations and seeing that people really were the key to unlock performance, and noticing that where an organization was able to really welcome everyone, inspire everyone, where people could thrive and not survive, you got just amazing performance. I mean, I liken that to what we experienced there together in our London office, Adam. I think we had just an amazing set of very different and creative, innovative people that together we did some pretty amazing things. And that for me, that sense of belonging now, you know, decades of research has shown that when you have diverse and inclusive teams and a culture where organization where people can thrive and there's a high sense of belonging, you get engagement off the chart, you get great performance, you get accelerated business results.
We had an amazing culture because I suppose we had psychological safety. Mm-hmm. We had, I don't know how, do you remember we tried to work out how many languages we spoke between, 25 of us? And there was something like 17 different languages.
Yeah.
And with that, and we came in all shapes and forms and colors and backgrounds. It really was. And with that, we had this incredible diversity of thought.
Yes.
And that diversity of thought, for me, was a real catalyst for the innovation, the creativity, and a lot of the fun that we had. But in some ways, I think you were partly responsible for that.
Oh, thank you. Why do you say that?
Well, if you think about it, we had a culture, didn't we, where it was very, very open, it was very, very flat, and it was very experimental in some ways. But I have a question for you, which was when you came across to London and you inherited us, and you inherited us all, did you have some things on your mind as a leader coming to a new region with a new team, albeit an organization you've been with for some time? Did you have some things at the forefront of your mind that generated what was that successful culture?
That's a great question. I actually did, because I always felt like the EMEA region and the London office was a jewel in the rough.
Right.
That the former organization had not paid enough attention to in order to really accelerate, you know, the possibilities and the results that were there. So I was very keen to just engage, to get to know the people, to understand all the unique capability that was there, and to figure out how to do something bigger, better, new, different for our clients, and in a way that would be authentic for all of us, which I think culturally we were a very fun, hardworking, and experimental group. I think experimenting is a great word to describe the things that we did.
I think, and sometimes we got away with it, and sometimes it didn't quite work out, which was great.
Exactly, but we learned from it and we moved on.
Well, do you know, that's a really interesting piece, Cheryl, because I think we weren't afraid to A, learn, and B, there was an element there where we weren't afraid to unlearn or undo some of the things. Well, any thoughts on that now, really, from a leadership point of view, about how we can, and especially we talk about our awareness of inclusivity and other issues, how do we learn and how do we sometimes unlearn from what we may have, even we're biased towards over the decades of our lives?
Yeah, you know, Heidrick's approach to accelerating D&I is based in decades of experience in culture shaping. So maybe 10 years ago, Heidrick acquired a firm, Cindelani Culture Shaping, started by a partner who is still active today at like 84 years old, Larry Sin, a personal hero of mine. I was just on a call with him like an hour ago.
Okay.
Our partner call. And Larry in the 1960s wrote the first PhD dissertation that called corporate culture a thing and built a business over those years in helping organizations shape healthy, thriving cultures. Now, Larry always intuitively believed that inclusion was part of a healthy, thriving culture, but hadn't focused, I think, as explicitly on that. When Heidrick decided to set up a D&I practice, we actually leveraged all of the learning from culture shaping and really sort of turned the dime into a new facet to say, how do you build an inclusive, thriving culture? And this whole idea of unfreezing, it's fundamental to our culture shaping methodology and fundamental to what we do around diversity and inclusion. In fact, our learning approach, we call it unfreezing inclusion. Because the theory from, you know, Lewin is that you may have some habits and behaviors that are holding you back. You're locked into those. And so you need to have insight-based learning and experience where you can personally change, personally have a mirror held up, see yourself, consider, reflect, and then try some things differently, do some things differently. So we have that's what we do in our work. And that's why I'm personally so passionate, because we're helping our clients unfreeze inclusion in their organization, which brings out really just a higher sense of belonging from everyone.
That's a really interesting phrase when you say unfreezing. Some people may not have heard that before. What do we mean in simple terms when we talk about unfreezing?
So there's a psychologist, Kurt Lewin, who had a theory around change. He's, you know, one of the modern pioneers of psychology. And, you know, the notion is freezing. It's unfreezing and refreezing. So when you want to change habit, and I'm generalizing, when you want to develop a new habit, you first have to unfreeze from the old. You have to try something new, and then you re-solidify. I don't know that I would ever say you refreeze, because freezing implies a rigidity and a solidness that, for me, would block learning.
Yeah, I agree.
But you re-solidify in a way that moves you farther towards your aspiration. So that's sort of what we're doing in our approach.
We see that, don't we? I suppose the global pandemic has just reinforced that the world is bonkers and is always changing. So maybe today is as simple as it gets. So we as leaders and organizations, we can't be static at all, can we? We've got to be constantly changing and morphing, because every day is different.
Absolutely. And it, for me, it ties to another area where Heidrick does a lot of work and has a lot of intellectual capital, and it's around this whole idea of agility.
Yes.
So I think you probably know, Adam, that we researched for many years the leaders in the FT 500 to find out what differentiates the best and highest performing organizations. And it's their ability to mobilize, execute, and transform with agility, or our framework is called META. And really, it's mobilize with agility, execute with agility, transform with agility, because agility, which we define as learning, foresight, adaptability, and resilience, it is agility which sets apart not just the highest performing organizations, but the highest performing teams, the highest performing leaders. And I think, in fact, I just, with a couple of colleagues, wrote just a short article at the start of the year called Get Curious. And it talks about two particular capabilities that leaders need to thrive in this, you know, continuation of COVID and post-COVID era. And it's our ability to be curious, because curiosity is fundamental for agility and it is fundamental for inclusion.
And that was an article you wrote, you said.
It is. I'll send you a copy of it. I'll send you a copy.
That would be great. Because the reason I've asked is you know I wrote my book, co-authored The Leader's Secret Code. And right. I don't know whether you know this, but when I was at the book launch, remember those days when we could actually be in a room together? There were about 120 people. I know. I crave those again. About 120 people. And someone said to me, Cheryl, out of all of the research that you did, and I did probably the majority of the face-to-face interviews with the Iconics, out of all of the experiences you've had and the research you did and the writing you did, what was the biggest learning or red thread for you? And in 1 millisecond, Cheryl, I thought, oh no, what am I going to say? But in the next split second, it was obvious. And I said it was about And by the way, this is, I think, incredibly relevant to you. I said the differentiator was human-centered leadership. It was the ability of the person to make tough decisions, do what was necessary for the collective, but always through the lens of being utterly human-centered. I always used to say that to you, Cheryl. You had great humility and empathy and acted in a way that always, in some ways, you might be, this might be your fault. You might have actually prompted me into this. we may have had a bit of a breakthrough moment for me where it may have been actually that prompted me. I don't think I knew what the label was, but it's human-centered leadership. And I've identified seven components. A number of them are things such as humility, empathy, and curiosity. And so that's something that's close to my heart. Tell me a little bit about what, you know, any kind of front of mind thoughts you might have about, I don't know, your approach to human-centered leadership, because you are very human-centered. And I think it's got also, by the way, one of the components is inclusivity, Cheryl.
Yeah, thank you. I love it. And I'll have to look more closely at your framework. it resonates for me, Adam, on so many levels. I mean, you know, my ethos is about human-centered leadership, because we can figure out the technology, we can figure out the systems and processes. It's people at the heart of what we do. And I really do believe a leader's call, a leader's job is to develop people, to engage people, to develop the capability of the organization, which I'm defining in terms of people. So I love humility, empathy, curiosity, and inclusivity, as you say. And our work at Heidrick, we talk about inclusive leaders. And, you know, our research has shown that there are, you know, five key traits to inclusive leaders. One of them is self-awareness. So having the ability to self-moderate, to be self-aware. Second, curiosity, absolutely. Yep. Empathy, vulnerability, and courage. And when you practice those abilities, you are more likely to be inclusive. You are more aware of how you are engaging people. You're more, the empathy allows you to see, as our friend Steve would say, through someone else's eyes, to be in your shoes, you know, and not to sympathize, which unfortunately in current events, a lot of people think empathy is synonymous with sympathy, and it's not. It's to empathize, to understand the emotion, the feeling, the behavior, the circumstance, and to do it from an objective fashion that allows you greater insight into that person. And you have to be curious about someone else's perspective or experience in order to have that level of empathy.
So this is the work that Heidrick have done in relation to the inclusive leader. You said those five elements. So let me just check I've got them. So self-awareness, curiosity, empathy, vulnerability, and courage.
Yes.
I love that. That's right. Where, anyone listening to this, Cheryl, where could they go to check that out, find out more?
Oh, if you go to our website, Heidrick, www.heidrick.com, you'll see a lot about our diversity and inclusion practice. We've got a lot of thought leadership on what inclusive leaders do. A lot of it comes from the base of assessments and diagnostics that we do, because, you know, we're a leadership firm. Yeah. At the end of the day, we advise on leaders, whether it's in the selecting of them, which many people know Heidrick as a recruiting firm, but we consult, and our consultancy is based on our years of experience in understanding what differentiates great leadership. And we continue to do research and to create new IP and approaches for our clients around developing great leaders, teams, and organizations.
One of the people that I interviewed, Cheryl, for my book and also who's been on the podcast was the wonderful John Amici, who is a former NBA player, a clinical psychologist, who was from Stockport, Manchester, and then made good in the NBA. He was incredible to speak to, but he said something to me I want to share with you because it stuck with me. He said that one of the biggest challenges for leaders, he said, was that interpersonal comfort trumps organizational change. So he said, not through mischief, but sometimes we go and we find people who look like us, sound like us, think like us, so that we are a homogenous group. But there we miss the inclusivity piece and the diversity of thought piece. So it's a challenge and it's something to be aware of, not through mischief. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you was, as people listen to this, and they could be leaders of themselves, individual leaders, they could be leaders of teams, small, medium, or large businesses, where does a leader who knows that inclusivity is absolutely essential and an essential ingredient for success, where could they start on this journey of inclusivity? Because it's not going to just change overnight, and we wish we could do that with society, but where do they start?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it really does relate to those five traits that I mentioned. Yep. So first is just even having self-awareness and noticing your own levels when it comes to, say, curiosity. You know, I think everybody has a default level, if you will, different traits. Like, I'm a naturally curious person. I was that child where, you know, I asked my parents 10,000 questions, right? So I've just been curious my whole life. However, when I encounter certain elements of difference, I notice that my curiosity can get pushed down. And so as a leader, I have to attune to when am I less curious than maybe I should be? And what can I do to get in the mindset of curiosity about, you know, this difference, this situation, this person, et cetera. Right. And so it really is starting with self-awareness and those traits that I mentioned, noticing what drives you up or down if you think of a scale in those areas. And we do have some tools and frameworks that we use with our clients in that arena. And it really is an activity of self-reflection, noticing what causes you to fluctuate, and then being intentional in trying something new or engaging in a different way so that you can get to the outcome that you'd like. So, you know, for example, if I experience someone with a very different cultural and religious background than mine, and maybe my default reaction might be not to be curious, I have to find a way to engage with them authentically.
Yes.
In an area, in an element of curiosity, to understand how they view the world and how their worldview might be different than mine. And at the end of the day, as you said earlier, it's about humans, right? Human-centered leadership. And when you begin to engage with people around their own diversity story, understanding sort of at their core what their experiences are, their views have been, we often find there's so much in common that we have. Yes, there are differences, and that makes us uniquely us. And I am definitely not an advocate of saying, oh, we're all the same. Let's just, you know, I don't see color. I tell people that's actually not a good thing to say. You know, if you don't see a Black woman when you see me, then you miss an important part of my identity.
Yeah.
I am a Black woman. However, that does not solely define me, and that doesn't put me into a particular box. The danger is when we, you know, of course, stereotype and generalize versus understanding everyone as unique human beings with a contribution to make.
Do you know, that's a great point. And I think I mentioned to you that I had Steve Mahaley and Dr. Randall Pinkett on one of the episodes, and he had talked us through the seven myths of racial equity. And one of them was, it's okay to be colorblind. People say, I don't see color. And he said, if you can't see my color, that's not a good thing. And you've just said the same thing that, and again, it, you know, for many people, it doesn't come from a place of mischief. It comes from the, you know what I mean? They're not coming at it from a negative way.
But
it's almost that we have to be able to see and appreciate the difference and be open to understanding the difference in order to embrace it and benefit from it. Because you and I have had the privilege of traveling all over the world to all kinds of cultures. So any thoughts on that? You know, the fact that we've just been able to expose ourselves to such a wonderful array of cultures.
Yes, and I really believe that because we've been so fortunate to have these experiences, it gives you a different perspective. You actually recognize that there are many ways of viewing a problem, a situation. Your way is not the only way. Your way is not the best way from someone else's experience. And so there's an openness that I believe being exposed to different cultures and places around the world. That's one of the reasons I actually wanted to move to the UK with my family. You may recall, my boys were young then. Our sons were 7 and 10.
Yes.
And we wanted them to experience just the wonderful diversity that London in particular has and that Europe has, quite frankly, so that they could experience being young men of color in a different context. And what I loved when Preston turned 12 and we had a birthday party at the house there, there were probably kids from 12 different national backgrounds there. Yeah. You know, and I just thought, I looked and I said, wow, I'm not sure that would ever happen in the US. And I'm so grateful for that experience. And, you know, they were able to travel to different cultures and countries more easily than it is from the US. And I just think it gave them such an appreciation for world history, for different cultures that I am hopeful will stick with them through their lives. And that will make them more inclusive as leaders, as people. And I already see it. I mean, even, you know, as we're back here in the US, they have a range of friends. They're open to experiences that maybe folks that haven't been as fortunate as them in their travels, maybe they aren't as open to. Incredibly grateful for that.
I had a conversation with another senior leader who talked about context creates performance. Very much about the environment and the culture that you create for people can get ordinary people to be extraordinary. You don't have to find the extraordinary person in the first place, but you can allow people to thrive. Mm-hmm. I wonder what the pandemic's done for it, because has it allowed organizations to rip up the rule book slightly and start again with their context, or even start again with their inclusivity? Have we been more inclusive because we've had no boundaries? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that has happened for many clients. I mean, we at Heidrick, we were holding and continue to hold forums for some of our clients, whether they're CHROs or CEOs or senior leaders.
Yes.
And we brought them from, you know, cross organizations just to talk together, to learn from each other. And one of the consistent themes that we heard was that a benefit of COVID is that, first of all, the mental models about how work is done have been totally shifted. You know, you don't have to be in an office 5 days a week for necessarily for every job. You know, you don't necessarily have to have permanent office spaces. And so even as we return, you know, you're seeing it, organizations reevaluating their footprint in terms of office space and how work happens. Now, we all know there's a real benefit to proximity and to, you know, building relationships, et cetera. So you've got to be attentive to keeping a culture and a relationship growing and thriving in a virtual setting, but there are definitely ways to do it. And I think organizations have had a shift that, you know, we won't return to the days of everyone going back same exact way. At least I'll say this, I don't think savvy organizations will return to exactly the same way.
I agree.
I think there's been productivity gains, there's been inclusivity gains that we should strive to understand and keep and build on as we move into this next phase, as vaccines are rolled out and as we go back to a more face-to-face context when we want to be face-to-face.
Listen, Cheryl, I could talk to you forever, but you know that, which would be unfair on your time. So a couple of questions. You're doing amazing work at Heidrick. And how can people get in contact to learn more? To engage, what's the best way?
Oh, well, absolutely. They can email me. I'm cstokes@heidrick.com. That's the easiest way.
Okay.
You can find me through our website. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. Just search my name, Cheryl Stokes. Welcome conversations. I'm very passionate about these topics of, you know, inclusivity and leadership and culture. It's been really my life's work over the last 30 years. And I'm very happy for this moment in history where some things have happened that have made it even more urgent for organizations to think about how to have leaders and teams and organizations that are more inclusive. And I think there's a recognition that inclusivity means everyone. It's not inclusivity to the detriment of others. It is creating, as you said, the context where all can thrive and survive, where we can get rid of some headwinds that people are facing and get more tailwinds for us all. That's what we're looking to do.
I'll subscribe to that, Cheryl, without a shadow of a doubt. I've got one final and fun question for you. You'll like this. Sure. What would be your best advice to a 21-year-old Cheryl?
Oh, my God. It was so long ago.
No, it wasn't that long ago, Cheryl. Come on.
It was three decades ago, at least. So I'd go back those more than three decades, and I would say to myself, enjoy the journey and value the connections that you make. Ensure that you keep those connections that are important to you. I've done that some. I haven't done it enough. I've gone back to look for people who were important mentors and who were important connections, because it is those connections that I think really help you, just help make the journey better for you. So that's the advice I would give myself.
And that's why I was so keen to connect with you, Cheryl, and have this conversation. The first of many, I hope, on the Leadership Enigma.
I hope. Thank you so much, Adam. This has been, of course, loads of fun. Great to connect with you, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Join us again next week for more essential insights on the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with your host on LinkedIn or via our website, www.pca-global.com. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. Thanks for listening.